Okay, my clock is showing 9, so we're about ready to start. Let me just make a few comments. I see we have a lot of new people. Just a few technical things. Well, first let me say this is our 5th, I think, series, maybe 6th. There's about 25 previous lectures available on the website. All of them are, I think they're like $3 Canadian. Those who want to listen to previous ones, although you can't see, you can certainly listen. The ones on Rav Kook, that was at the way beginning when we were still getting hang of this, and technically they didn't come out 100%, and although it lists them as costing something, if you email in, you can get them for free. We began with series on 19th century modern Orthodox figures. We looked at other important Orthodox figures, not modern Orthodox, and when I say modern Orthodox, as we'll see, those who've been with us know, I don't mean that any of the figures we're going to deal with are what we would call today modern Orthodox, but they have certain characteristics and advocate certain ideas which have been adopted by many, not all modern Orthodox thinkers today. There are some aspects of people we look to, such as Samson Raphael Hirsch. We spend a good deal of time on his ideology of separatism, which today is far from a modern Orthodox idea. The way it works is that I speak, and you can all, at the bottom there, you can send in questions while we're going. I will stop at various times and ask. You can also speak by clicking on the transmit button. If you want to speak and I'm in the middle and I haven't yet paused, it's best to send a note and just say you want to say something. Sometimes it's 3 or 4 people speaking at once, but usually it works out nicely. At the end, I'll stop about 5 minutes or 10 minutes before the end, and there'll be time for questions. If you don't want to appear on screen, you obviously don't have to, and you can also stack the pictures. If you don't want to see other people, you can actually stack them on top of each other. You can make my picture bigger if you want, or anyone else's picture. It really is very good technology, and it's very unusual that a problem develops. It could happen maybe that something freezes, but it usually doesn't happen, and we have Shalom in Toronto standing by and other people. So without any further ado, let me just ask, does anyone have any problems before we begin? We are going to be starting for 2 classes on Rav Uziel, and we have, I think, with us, if not one of Rav Uziel's grandchildren is in Toronto, if I'm not mistaken, and they are sponsoring the event in, I think it's their 80th birthday. So I want to thank them and thank the people who have sponsored this in the past. And let us then begin without any further ado. Today we begin looking at Rav Ben Zion Uziel, late 19th to the mid-20th century, died in 1953. He is the first of the Sephardic post-scheme Sephardic authorities we will be looking at. He's not the last. We will look at the end of this series on Rav Joseph Kafach, the great Yemenite scholar. There are others that I do want to look at. Just looking at them, they are as significant as the Ashkenazic authority, again, historically, and that's why we devoted the earlier classes to the Ashkenazic. I'm told that I froze a bit, perhaps. I do want to thank the Uziel family. We have a grandchild of Rav Uziel, who the family is sponsoring in her honor, these lectures. He's a very important 20th century post-seik. If you look at any halachic works, take Rabbi Bleich's books, for example, look in the index, you'll see him mentioned all the time. They've recently reprinted all of his volumes. There's some are quite thick. This is not that thick, but I will say there's a problem, however, because they removed in one of the volumes the approbations. The approbations are important historically, and they're also important because some of the approvers, the maskinim, engage in halachic debates. And what makes these volumes valuable is that they are exact duplicates of the original. When volumes are reprinted today with a new typeset, you always have to be worried because they cut things out, or there's censorship. So I was shocked when I saw that they took out the Haskamot, and I wrote to the person who's in charge of the reprints, and he wrote back to me that Rav Uziel is so great, he doesn't need anyone's approbation, which is, of course, is ridiculous, because first of all, when he wrote the works, he wasn't that great. He needed the approbations, the early volumes. Second of all, the approbations themselves are of great significance. You have Rav Kook's approbation, and you have Rav Herzog's. Be that as it may, the volumes are available, and you can get them very easily. He is one of the last of the pure Sephardic poskim. What do I mean when I say pure? The Sephardic world, to a large extent, has been anazified. First of all, in simple matters, if you look at a Sephardic yeshiva today, you see the way they dress. Even the Rosh Yeshiva, they've adopted the Ashkenazic black and white dress, which actually comes from the Hasidic world. If you look at pictures of the Lithuanian yeshivas, even into the 1960s, you did not have this uniform. You did not have the black. The people who wore black were the Rosh Yeshiva. The average yeshiva students wore all sorts of colors, gray, and they wore hats. They always wore hats, but they weren't black hats. So the Sephardic world in that sense is adopted, but more significant. Yes, and they're elites. This might be changing now, but for many, many years, the Sephardim they didn't have any real yeshivas of their own, and they certainly to this day don't have quality girls' schools, so it's very important that they send their kids to the Ashkenazi schools, the Beis Yaakovs. And those who read the Israeli press will recall last summer when it was exposed that in the city of Emmanuel, a very Haredi city, the Beis Yaakov there actually segregated the Ashkenazi girls and the Sephardic girls. Even at the playground, there was a fence. God forbid that the Sephardic girls will even talk to the Ashkenazi girls. And this is an old story of Ashkenazi discrimination, Ashkenazi literal segregation, and quotas against the Sephardim. Recently, you have a number of men's yeshivot that have been opened up by Sephardim, and they don't feel the need anymore to go to places like Hebron and Ponevej, although there are those who do, because there are those Sephardim whose fathers came from those yeshivas. In terms of girls' school, they haven't yet opened up that many. This is the influence of Rav Avad Yosef. Ashkenazified, I mean it both maybe in a negative sense and not in a negative sense. People like Rav Uziel were still operating from a Sephardic curriculum. That is, there was a canon of Sephardic halacha. You think of people like the Ben Ish Chai and the Kaf HaChaim and Rav Chaim Palachi. They didn't know of and they didn't quote the Aruch HaShulchan, the Mishnah Brura. They were totally separate from the Ashkenazic world. They had their own canon and their own authorities. And by the same token, Ashkenazic poskim basically quoted one Sephardic Kathar, that was the Shulchan Aruch. Now you'll see them quote other. You'll see them quote maybe Rav Avad. Yeah, they quote very little, but the Sephardim quote all the Ashkenazim. Perhaps the negative aspect is a rising tide of extremism that didn't exist in the 1950s. It really didn't exist until the last 20 years. Anti-Zionism, for example, was never something found in the Sephardic world, as we'll talk about in a few minutes. The Ashkenazim had this whole hang-up because you had the Mizrahi and you had the Aguda, and anti-Zionism became an important factor of Haredi Judaism. In fact, you can't be a Zionist and be a Haredi. The two are contradictory. And you really can't be a modern Orthodox if you're not a Zionist. They're identifying factors. The Sephardic world never had the issues of political Zionism. They never had the issues of secular studies. You had some, I guess we'd say we would call extremists in Aleppo, but for the most part, the Sephardic world never had this issue. They never had the problem of work versus learning. All these issues, which are Ashkenazic issues, were not part of the Sephardic world until very recently. First of all, it doesn't need to deal with Ashkenazic authorities, and it doesn't know an Ashkenazic mentality. Rav Avadia, as we spoke about, is a somewhat pure Ashkenazic, a Sephardic posel in many of his pronouncements. So that's why we're going to see with Rav Uziel, the Sephardim were able to do things that the Ashkenazim couldn't, because the Ashkenazim had a history of dealing with these matters. He was able to decide, as I said, halacha usual for Ashkenazic poskim, says we can't adopt new ideas, is directed against the Reform movement.
We are having some sound difficulties because the internet is shaky.
Stanley, can you hear me? Let's hold on for a second here. As I said, this is very rare. Okay. No one's typing in? I can't. Can people type in to let me know if it's, if you... Okay, does anyone not hear? everyone not hear me? I'm talking now. Is anyone not here? I'm talking now. Can you hear me?
I hear you, Mark. Hopefully it'll continue and not be erratic.
No sound here. Yeah, everyone's cutting out. An update? Okay, someone tried. Is that making any difference? I'm talking now. Okay. Does everyone hear me? Those who've unplugged, does anyone not hear me? Maybe that's the solution so they get the more stuff. Okay. So let's go for this from now. You can see me. I can't see you, but you can certainly send in the questions. I had one person say it's erratic, but others say it's much better. Maybe some others, maybe everyone who has their camera on should pull it off until they get this thing handled. And I'm going to go back to where I stopped off, and I'll speak slowly. What I was saying was that the Ashkenazic authorities don't quote the Sephardic authorities until very recently, and only Rav Avadia. And the Sephardic authorities, until very recently, didn't quote the Ashkenazic authorities. Now, of course, you have the Mishnah Berurah, the Aruch HaShulchan, and all. And Rav Uziel stands at the era before modernity. Other than Jonathan, I don't know, Jonathan, maybe try the tech people. Everyone else, make sure you didn't unplug your thing. I'm going to have to go, though. I'm sorry. We'll get you a tape of the thing if you can't listen in, but everyone else seems to, so I don't want to stop unless other people email me that it's a problem. Rav Uziel was able to decide halacha, as I said, in a pure Sephardic approach without the Ashkenazic influence. Let me quickly go over, for those who didn't hear, what I meant by the Ashkenazic influence. Ashkenazic yeshivot, which we have today, they have this certain form of extremism, this anti-Zionist extremism, which goes back to Europe. Now, we have the Chidan of Ben Ishchai. No, when you say you had the Ben Ishchai and was a big collector of books, but basically, for the most part, the Sephardim had their own tradition, their own canon of books. Sephardim always quoted Ashkenazi more than Sephardim, and occasionally people would quote. But they really were pretty much separate. And even more so, was the mentality. I'll repeat this because I don't know if you heard it. You had all these battles in Europe, battles over secular education, battles over Zionism, battles over separatism. You had Reform and conservative Judaism. You didn't have any of these things in the Sephardic world. So therefore, Ashkenazic authorities often would, for example, they would have tshuvot, responsa, and then they would conclude that technically speaking, something's permitted according to halakha. But because we're in the midst of a battle against the reformers or the conservatives, we can't have any leniencies. The Chatam Sofer's expression, his phrase, anything new is forbidden from the Torah, is directed against the era he's living in, the reformers. What would be the case if you had a society in which you didn't have to add these caveats, in which you could decide the halakha the way you thought it was? Of the classic example, I mentioned this in the last series, Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky has an entire responsa showing why gelatin is permissible according to Jewish law. And at the end he says, but we can't permit it because the conservatives have been said to work. The Chatam Sofer's comment was not made as a joke. On the contrary, it's a play on words from the notion of chadash, chadash asur, meaning you can't eat the new produce. But it was not only was it not made as a joke, it became his operating principle in the battle against reform. And he quotes it in a number of his tshuvot. So it began as a nice pun, but it has the ideology behind it is very real. Rav Uziel, therefore, stands at the end of this era, before we enter into a new era where the Ashkenazim and Sephardim are much more mixed. We now have one doctoral dissertation, which focuses to a great extent on him, and also this book by Rabbi Mark Angel, Loving Truth and Peace, The Grand Religious Worldview of Rabbi Ben-Zion Uziel, which I'll speak about in a bit. It is not an academic scholarly book, but it is not just a popular book. There's a lot of learning in it, but written in a popular fashion. I don't know, so I'll repeat it also. I don't know if I mentioned before I was cut off, secular studies and the fact that this opposition, going to university or learning or full-time learning supported by the community, these are very Ashkenazic things, which recently have begun to influence the Sephardim as well. So we still have a pure Sephardi postseg in Rav Uziel. Rav Avadia, as I mentioned, semi-pure, but not completely. Well, the Hasidic movement didn't take root in Sephardim because there were no Hasidim there. There was no ideology there. It takes place, it's a European phenomenon. The whole situation is different there, the economic situation, the social situation. Had Hasidic rebbes decided to go to these countries and start preaching, but let's not forget, you also didn't have the stark elitism. You didn't have the rich people versus the poor. However you want to interpret Hasidut, a lot of these things were lacking. The many great scholars in this Sephardic world worked like everyone else. Although it's an interesting question you raise, when the Hasidic figures went to Morocco, for example, Lubavitchers, right after the war, they created huge followings. You have Hasidic, not Hasidic leaders, Hasidic emissaries. The Sephardic world picked up on Hasidut, the ideology of mysticism, belief in holy figures. There's a lot of similarities, but the phenomenon were completely different. Breslov, that's right. If you daven at a Breslov shul, you will see many people davening with Sephardic Sephardic Sidurim, Sephardic Machzorim. If you go to Uman is full of Sephardim, so there's a lot of attachment there, and it's no accident that in Israel, many of the Hasidic leaders became very close to Sephardi mystics. The Baba Sali, for example, was revered by Hasidim, who would always go to him, so there are great similarities. There are things in the Sephardim which I don't believe you have in Ashkenazim. For example, holy water. Not far from where I live, some Sephardi mystic came not too long ago giving out holy water. I don't know if the Hasidim ever had holy water. And Hasidut is not identical with Kabbalah. It uses mysticism, but it's different. But yet there are great similarities. Okay, returning to Rav Uziel. He's born in 1880. His father was Rabbi Raphael Uziel. Raphael's a pretty popular name among Sephardim, not only given if you're ill. He was an Av Beit Din, head of one of the Batei Din of the Sephardim in Jerusalem. His mother was from the famous Chazan family. I don't know if there's anyone here who knows people named Chazan. There were many Rishonei Letzion, that is, Sephardic chief rabbis from this family. There was a great figure who we'll probably deal with in a future series, Yisrael Moshe Chazan. Many important rabbis named Chazan. Jose, for those who are fans of Jose Faur, he has a book on Yisrael Moshe Chazan, which automatically should show you that he's an interesting figure. In addition to knowing Hebrew, Arabic, and Turkish, Rav Uziel also knew French. It was quite popular, quite common, for the Sephardic rabbis, the great Sephardic rabbis, to give their children secular educations. You had Ashkenazim who gave the children education also, but usually these were the more wealthy people. You didn't usually have the rabbis of the town hiring private tutors. It wasn't uncommon in the Sephardic world. Education, per se, was not something looked down on, certainly not in the Turkish areas, not in Egypt. You had certain extremists in Aleppo. This was an issue in Syria. But in the Sephardic world in general, it was not looked down as a psul. Those who know the history of Rav Soloveitchik will recall that it wasn't his father. His father didn't want to give him any secular education. It was actually his mother, who was much more enlightened than his father, who made sure that he got a good secular education. He taught at various schools in the land of Israel, and in 1911, he became chief rabbi of Yafo, Tel Aviv. And this enabled him to Tel Aviv, you know, the new city was growing, but Yafo was the older city and was more established. Rav Kook, about 7 years previously, had become chief rabbi of Yafo, not Tel Aviv, but Yafo, right next to each other. He developed a very close relationship with Rav Kook, and they would have certain disputes, but a very close relationship, as we will see. Unlike Rav Kook, Rav Uziel had close relationships with non-Jews. This is another trend which you find in the Sephardic world more than the Ashkenazic world. Typically, the Ashkenazic Jews, the traditionalists, they didn't have any relationships other than maybe a business relationship. But they lived in their ghettos, and you didn't have friendships, you didn't have any real relationships. When we get to Rav Kafach, we'll see how he studied, just like Maimonides did. He studied the sciences and basic philosophy with Arabic teachers. This is something that was much more popular, it always has been, in the Sephardic world. We have Ashkenazim who crossed these barriers, but it was much less common. In fact, these relationships he had with the non-Jews helped. It's a famous story during I wouldn't call it a pogrom, but attacks by Arabs in the land of Israel against Jews, rock throwing, even some shooting in one of the cities. Rav Uziel personally went and was able to meet with the sheikh there, and he could speak Arabic to him. And it's a famous story that after Rav Uziel's intervention, this same thing happened later with Rav Toledano, but with Rav Uziel's intervention, the Arab mob abandoned the assault and left. And that's told everywhere. In the literature on Rav Uziel, Rav Uziel has a grandson who wrote a memoir about him, and I read that a couple weeks ago, and the first time I learned that the story is not complete. It turns out that after Rav Uziel left and after the Arabs left, they came back a few hours later and started up again with their rock throwing and attacking Jews. But it still says something that Rav Uziel, as the leader of the Jews, had a certain amount of respect with the local sheikhs. I know that Rabbi Riskin and his settlement has tried to imitate this idea of having good relations, inviting the Arab leaders to their town for celebrations and going to their town. That's a typical Sephardic mentality. The fact that Islam was never regarded as a form of Avodah Zarah meant that there were less problems. They didn't feel difficulties in going, let's say, to pay their respects at a wedding or to visit a funeral, after a funeral, to visit the people. With Christians, rabbis always had concerns. Are you involving yourself in idolatrous ceremonies? So it was quite different. Yayin Nesach is interesting. You had Sephardic authorities who ruled that there is no Yayin Nesach. We shouldn't use the word Yayin Nesach. You should say Stam Yenam. The question is, if a non-Jew touches the wine, most ruled that you cannot drink it, but if a Muslim touches it, you can get benefit from it. But there were Sephardic authorities who ruled that you can even drink the wine of a Muslim precisely because they're not idolaters. And the other issue about intermarriage, that's a later idea that was thrown in, presumably thrown in to add extra strength to it for just this circumstance, if you're dealing with non-Jews who are not idolaters. But that's the standard view, is that even if the Muslims touch the wine, but obviously there are differences. We're in a sabbatical year. The land is sold only to a Muslim during the Shemitah year. It'll never be sold to a Christian. There's a famous case where Muslims left during Serbia. There was a war, and they abandoned their mosque. Now, if non-Jews abandon their church, we can't use it. There has to be a certain, it's called bitul. They have to show that they don't want it anymore. But Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan decided that a mosque, there's no problem with a mosque. Just go in and start davening because it's a kosher house of worship. So the relationship between Jews and Muslims, not to mention the fact that Jewish life in the Islamic world was always much better than Jewish life in the Christian world. I know now you have some revisionists trying to argue that it wasn't so peachy keen in the Islamic world, but the fact is Jews lived as dhimmis. And for the most part, although there were exceptions, they were given autonomy and they were spared from expulsions and pogroms and blood libels. What you have today in the Islamic world, just go to memory.org, is really a modern phenomenon. So the relationships were much better. Yes, they were second-class citizens, but they had a more stable life. In 1923, Rav Uziel even traveled to Iraq, where he had negotiations with King Faisal, and the king permitted, based upon these negotiations, Zionist activities to continue in his country. Zionist activities were going on there, and they didn't have the anti-Zionism as they later would have. In 1921, he leaves the land of Israel to go to Salonika, to become chief rabbi there. Salonika, of course, is a famous Jewish city. The ports were closed in Salonika every Shabbos because Jewish workers refused to work. There were times in the 19th century and the early 20th century where some people think that even half the population of Salonika was Jewish. It had the largest percentage of Jews of any big city. Then there was a great fire and other things, and the population declined. But even when Rav Uziel came there, Jews were very dominant in trade and merchants in Salonika. There also was a great Dunne presence. Until the early 20th century, there was a recognized community of believers in Shabtai Tzvi, the Dunne. Then they were active in the Young Turks. Then it sort of disappeared, although they haven't disappeared completely. But Salal Naor has a book. It's written under one of his pseudonyms, Reuven Alpert, I think it is. But he has a book which he published a couple years ago. You can buy it on Orot.com. I think it's still available. In which he talks about going and meeting the current Dunne, the current believers of Shabtai Tzvi in Turkey, who are still around today. He was only there for 2 years. And then he returns back to Tel Aviv, Jaffa, which is certainly growing, it's a big city already, as chief rabbi. He then leaves shortly after that in 1925 and travels to the United States, where he even meets with President Calvin Coolidge. There was we always think of the immigration from Eastern Europe coming to the U.S. on the Lower East Side. There was a Sephardic community in Manhattan, the Lower East Side as well. Syrians had emigrated here. You had Turkish Jews here. You had Jews from Rhodes who were out in Washington, but also in New York. So you had a very small Sephardic community. And he comes to America. And in 1939, after having returned to Israel, he is elected Rishon LeZion, chief rabbi of the land of Israel, of Palestine. What is this position, Rishon LeZion? Well, in the 17th century, the leading rabbis in Jerusalem, and they were all Sephardim, you only had a few Ashkenazim, no leading rabbinic figures until the 19th century, but you always had a Sephardic presence. They decided to appoint one rabbi who would be their leader, and they gave him the title Rishon LeZion, first in Zion, although if you look in Isaiah 41:27, where the title comes, where the words appear, it doesn't mean that over there, it means something else. And this position remains until today, Rishon LeZion. What happened is that when the British took over the land of Israel during World War I, they created an institution of chief rabbinate, and both an Ashkenazic chief rabbi and a Sephardic chief rabbi were elected, and the Sephardic chief rabbi also held the title Rishon LeZion. Today, it turns out that there are four rabbis who hold the title Rishon LeZion, because you have elections now. That's not the way it used to be. It used to be that they remained Rishon LeZion until they died or were senile. Chacham Bashi is the Turkish title. The head of the Ottoman Empire, that is, the chief rabbi of the Ottoman Empire, was called the Chacham Bashi. And sometimes you'll see the Rishon LeZion, they call him the Chacham Bashi, but it's a different position. And the Chacham Bashi was sat in Turkey, and his authority extended out over Syria, over Lebanon, over Egypt sometimes, wherever the Ottoman Empire was, and it also ascended, was over the land of Israel. However, the Rishon LeZion was thought to be an independent authority. So I guess you could say it's almost like in the Catholic Church, you have the various patriarchs and you have the Pope. They like to say they're first among equals. The Rishon LeZion was thought, it was his fiefdom, the land of Israel. The Chacham Bashi was technically over him because the Ottoman Empire controlled the land of Israel, but in reality, for the Jews of the land of Israel, the Rishon LeZion was the one. And you had disputes at times, but the Rishon LeZion only covered the land of Israel, the Chacham Bashi covered elsewhere. And then later we have important figures appointed in Syria, and the position of Chacham Bashi is reduced to only Turkey. A book came out this year, or last year, 2007, by Yisrael Harel. The whole book is devoted to, and this is the title, Deposing of Rabbis in, I think it's in Syria and Turkey, because you had, as you can imagine, all sorts of politics. You had a number of Chacham Bashis who were deposed. There was great disputes. Don't think that it's only the Ashkenazim who had these disputes. But the Rishon, as far as I know, there were never such disputes among the Rishon LeZion. The Rishon LeZion worked in league with the Sultan's emissary in the land of Israel. The holders of this position were all Sephardic rabbis. As I said, until with the increase of the Ashkenazic population in the 19th century, they did appoint an Av Beit Din. There were always Rav Salant and Rav Diskin and others, but they never held official positions. And in the first one of the early classes with Rav Kook, we dealt with why it is that the great scholars always had to come from Lithuania. All the people in Israel were just sitting learning Torah all day. They were supported. That's a topic for another time. But you do have Torah scholars in the land of Israel from the Ashkenazic world, really the late 19th century, that is internationally renowned. There always were Ashkenazim. Since the 18th century, you have the students of the Vilna Gaon, you have Chassidim. But you have real important Ashkenazic figures. You have then the Aderet, Rav Kook's father-in-law. But the position only becomes official after the British take over. Now, Rav Uziel, who serves as Rishon LeZion and chief rabbi before and after the state, and he's the only one, him and Rav Herzog are the ones to do this, he was an unabashed Zionist. He was a Mizrahi figure. Mizrahi is very much an Ashkenazi phenomenon. But Rav Uziel was a big supporter of Mizrahi. And it's not surprising, like I said before, the Sephardic world never had an anti-Zionism. I have a couple books downstairs. I should have brought one up. Maybe I'll bring one up next week, which goes through religious Zionism in the Sephardic world. Now, they wouldn't call it religious Zionism. They were not in, if you went to Morocco or you went to Egypt, there was no political parties there. There wasn't Mizrahi, but they were all lovers of Zion. These notions that you have in the Ashkenazic world, and particularly in Hungary and Poland and others, that the land of Israel, that's a messianic dream, that's not something we should go to now, this wasn't found in the Sephardic world. It is only in very modern times that you have anti-Zionism in the Sephardic world. There's always a figure here or there, but the Eda Haridit, the anti-Zionism, Agudas Yisrael, these are Ashkenazic phenomena. Rav Uziel was the leader of the Sephardim. There was no right-wing opposition to him. It's not like you have the Ashkenazic Rav Kook and you have Rav Sonnenfeld and the Haredim. You never had that in the Sephardic world. They were all united around their chief rabbi. And truthfully, they continued, and they do continue. He published, let me get a few more things before we go to some of his publications. When the British took over and they instituted this chief rabbinate with both an Ashkenazi and chief rabbi, and this is the way it's remained, unless the current chief Ashkenazic rabbi is thrown out of his positions,
they also instituted a court system. There always was a system of Bate Din, but it wasn't an official court system, and we'll get back to that in a minute. But in addition to that, they brought a modern army to the land of Israel, the British Army. And Rav Uziel was a great supporter of Jews in the army. There were Jews, British citizens, there were others who enlisted in this army. They enlisted in World War I. You had Jews who came over from England when it was conquered. You had Jewish legions. Later in World War II, of course, you had Jewish legions. Already at the beginning, you see Rav Uziel in the early 20th century writing about, and this is interesting, how to be a soldier and to be a Jew, there's nothing in opposition to it. He encourages his own children to join the army, to join the British Army later on, in World War I and in World War II. Jews were very much in support of the British because they knew that they were bringing freedom. They knew that there was democracy versus this corrupt Turkish Empire. This becomes, as we will see, very important halakhically and historically, because one of the great disputes between the religious Zionists with the opening of the beginning of the state and the Haredim are, do Orthodox need to involve themselves in warfare, or is it enough for Jews simply religious Jews to study Torah and let the non-religious Jew carry the burden? So remember this, that Rav Uziel was, even in World War I, spoke about the importance of serving your country, or serving the good cause. Now, Rabbi Angel, in this book, has a chapter which deals with Rav Uziel's openness to culture and his wide-ranging secular studies. He's not known. He's not like Rav Herzog. We're not dealing with a figure who went to the university, who was an academic figure, but someone who had a love for and openness for secular culture, as all Sephardic gentlemen always had. The Sephardi who wasn't open to secular culture was the one who couldn't afford it, who was never exposed to it. There's always been this notion. You think of the Confucian gentleman advocated by Confucius. Well, you always had an ideal of a Sephardic gentleman, and secular studies and culture was always very much a part of it. And Rav Uziel points out something very interesting, which is, of course, very Maimonidean. I think most of us probably remember the very first Rashi on Chumash. Rashi begins, why does the Torah start with the creation of the world? Why doesn't it begin with the first commandment? And, or at least the first explicit commandment, because most people think the first commandment is Pru Urvu. It should start in Shemot somewhere. Rav Uziel sees a different message. Rashi says, well, this is to show people that this is the land, the world is created by God, and if he wants to give us the land of Israel, he can. Rav Uziel sees the fact that it begins with Genesis. It begins universally, not particularly. It doesn't begin with a particularistic Jewish message, but with a universalistic human message, as teaching us that we need to be engaged in theological pursuits. We need to look at things outside of halacha. We need to look at the world, to involve ourselves with it. That's, of course, the Rambam's message. He begins Yesodei HaTorah, the beginning of the Mishnah Torah, with a universal message, the importance of the study of science. And Rav Uziel saw the same thing, that yes, we're all Jews, and that's special, and that defines us, but we're also universal people. And the Torah itself begins with a universal message. Now, his greatest significance is, as I mentioned, his halachic significance, the various volumes of the Mishpatei Uziel, of which there are 9 of. They were digested about 20 years ago into a volume called Piskei Uziel, where his most famous and important psukim were recorded, are included in that volume. And unfortunately, the Bar Ilan CD-ROM only has the Piskei Uziel. But if you go to HebrewBooks.org, you can find, if you don't want to buy the books, you can see all of his books. He does show a very original method. Those who know Sephardic poskim today, and this was a Sephardic trait, there's great Bekiyut, Rav Avad Yosef, even Rav Chaim Palachi and others. They quote thousands of sources. That's not Rav Uziel. He's analytical. He's has a close reading of texts, a beautiful Hebrew. He has a number of volume of drashot, of essays called Hegyonei Uziel. They're about 7 volumes. There's about 25 volumes that either have been published or are about to be published of Rav Uziel's writings. He left an enormous amount, maybe 20 volumes. But of course, as I said, his greatest significance is in halacha. And in the introduction to volume 1, he actually quotes the Chatam Sofer. He says, there are those who believe that anything new is forbidden from the Torah.
And he's referring to the Ashkenazic approach, which was very popular, certainly not dominant, not everyone, but it was a popular approach. And he knew this approach from the land of Israel, because the land of Israel had a strong Hungarian and a strong extremist community who were anti-Zionist, who believed that the settlements in the land were forbidden, that they had to remain studying Torah until the Messiah comes. Rav Uziel polemicizes against this and says, on the contrary, what is new is not forbidden from the Torah necessarily, but we need to look into it, we need to examine it. With Rav Uziel, we see the principle of kocha de hatera, the striving for leniency. Of course, like every post-seik, he is sometimes strict. But there is no doubt that Rav Uziel has a lenient tendency, so much so we'll see some of his decisions that they've gone very much out of style, even among the Sfaradim, Rav Yosef, although he quotes Rav Uziel all the time, he loves Rav Uziel, he takes issue with some of Rav Uziel's more lenient opinions. If you read the introduction to Rav Uziel, though, he reminds me of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Remember when we did Rav Moshe Feinstein, he writes in the introduction that a post-seik cannot be one who's afraid and therefore won't decide halakha. A post-seik needs to fearlessly decide any question that comes before him. Otherwise, he's not a post-seik. If he doesn't know the answer, he doesn't know the answer. But a post-seik cannot come to a conclusion and then say, but I'm afraid, let someone else do it. Rav Uziel says the exact same thing. He's responding to some rabbi who didn't want to decide a question about a Jew going up in an elevator on Shabbos when a non-Jew pushed the button. He said he's afraid. And Rav Uziel said, how could you be afraid? That's your job as a Rav, to decide the questions. Your version of Bar Ilan has 4 volumes. Oh, okay, well, I don't have the newest version of Bar Ilan. That's good. I don't know. As I said, there are now 9 volumes of Mishpatei Uziel. Rav Uziel showed that he was dynamic also. He supported the establishment of a Sanhedrin, which would revitalize and revamp Orthodox Jewish life. Rav Herzog was opposed to it. The Haredim were terrified of it. No Ashkenazic authority could support it without everyone falling upon him and accusing him of being a reformer. Rav Uziel saw this as a natural step. Now that we have a state, now that we're establishing ourselves, we reestablish the Sanhedrin, and all sorts of gezeirot and takanot can be established and be revoked. Not everything that was established by the rabbis of ancient days need to stay today. If we have a Sanhedrin, we can do all sorts of things. We will see how much Rav Uziel did without a Sanhedrin. We're going to talk about his view of the role of women, and one of the areas that you can't overcome is women as witnesses, for example, at weddings or divorces, things like that, because that's ritualistic. Well, if we had a Sanhedrin today, that could be changed, all sorts of things. There are no sword sheets, no sword sheets at all, although sometimes I'll mention things, and if you want, I'll send them to you. Rav Uziel has a chapter called Universal Concerns in Rav Uziel, and this is significant also, and I congratulate Rabbi Angel for picking up on this. Many poskim, I would say most poskim, are very particularistic. Some of you probably recall Rabbi Meiselman's article about the Rav a few years back, in which he argues that that's the way that you should be. You should be particularistic. Jews, traditional Jews, should not be concerned about things outside our communities. In other words, with Darfur or anything of that nature. We have reached a point now where if you speak about social justice or speak about things like Darfur, they think you're a reform rabbi. Quite apart from the fact that, I mean, it's very foolish. So, you know, you quote Isaiah, and people think you're a reform rabbi. The very notion that basic Jewish ideals have somehow been forgotten because the reform think that they're important is, in addition to being crazy, it's a distortion of traditional Judaism. It's a violation of so much of what we should stand for. But that is the world we live in. Rav Uziel fought against this. He said that we have to be troubled by injustice no matter where it takes place, not to mention the fact that the utter hypocrisy. Jews like to accuse the world of forgetting about us, of closing the doors of America, of not caring when Jews in Europe were being killed. And if Jews today in the United States don't care that non-Jews elsewhere are being killed, by what measure can they feel anger that the non-Jews didn't care about the Jews? We see the particularistic aspect of Judaism, which goes back to Yehuda Halevi, and really is dominant today, and Menachem Kellner's new book speaks about that. but there's a universalistic aspect of Judaism that is also around there. And Rabbi Angel cites a very good example of this in a dispute between Rav Kook, who was a particularist, even though he had certain universalistic tendencies, he was very much a particularist, as his students are, in the question about autopsies in the state of Israel. There's a Jewish medical school, can they dissect bodies? Rav Kook said autopsies are a problem. He thought that maybe we could find a heter, but his answer was, what do we need a heter for? Let's use non-Jewish bodies. A Jewish body is holy. Jews regard their bodies as holy. Therefore, we cannot dissect them. Non-Jews don't have that issue. So let's use non-Jewish bodies. Rav Uziel, in addition to the fact that he thought there was no problem with autopsies, because today the medical science needs it, he was horrified at this notion of Kavod HaMeit would be regarded as a Jewish thing. On the contrary, he says Kavod HaMeit is a universal thing, and there's no distinction here between Jews and non-Jews. Okay, is there still a freeze? I was saying that Rav Uziel was very opposed to Rav Kook's notion that the Jewish bodies are somehow holy. A brain death. I don't know. He never dealt with brain death. It was before his time. But his point is there's no such thing as a special... This is the Yehuda Levi idea that somehow Jews have this special nature, even in death. And Rav Uziel said, absolutely not. This is not the only time he feuded with Rav Kook. His most famous dispute with Rav Kook, I think, has to do with pronunciation. Rav Kook argued that Ashkenazic Jews must keep to the Ashkenazic pronunciation. And Rav Uziel said, no, the Sephardic pronunciation, first of all Sephardim think, rightly or wrongly, more rightly, that their pronunciation is the truer one. They distinguish more letters and more vowels, not necessarily the Israeli pronunciation, but the typical Sephardic pronunciation, although not necessarily, they don't distinguish all consonants, but they distinguish more than we do. He thought that in the land of Israel, where the Sephardim have always lived, Ashkenazim can certainly adopt their pronunciation. Another example, women's suffrage. This is probably the most famous. People have this conception, not those who are on our Rav Kook classes, but the outsiders, that Rav Kook is somehow a modern Orthodox rabbi of sorts. The truth is, Rav Kook is a very traditional, a very pious, old-fashioned rabbi who has a lot of modern ideas. But fundamentally, day in and day out, if you went to see him, he was postening shaylas, he was studying, he was a parush, an ascetic. I mean, he literally never looked at women. He never looked at money. Stories are legendary. They had to eventually pay his Rebbetzin, the weekly salary, because they'd give him the money. He had no conception of money. Poor people would come to his house, and they'd just give them all the money he had. And then his wife would come to get the money to buy the Shabbos food, and there was literally no money. Rav Kook believed, and the modern Orthodox who look to Rav Kook, this is obviously not something they can look to, the woman's place is in the home. The very notion that women would go out and vote and be involved in politics, and he thought, first of all, it would destroy Shalom Bayis, because if the woman has an opinion, today on TV I saw Maria Shriver, she's out campaigning for Obama, and Arnold Schwarzenegger for McCain. Rav Kook said that if a woman has an opinion in these matters, it'll destroy Shalom Bayis. The woman's role is in the house. The man's role is to conquer the world and be out there. And therefore, the concept that a woman, and it's not a question just of sneers of going to the voting booths, the very notion that a woman should have any involvement, that to Rav Kook is a violation of the woman's role. So he's a real traditionalist. Rav Uziel, however, who was a much more worldly person to a certain extent. He had traveled. Rav Kook had traveled too, but Rav Uziel was much more cultured. He had involvements that Rav Kook didn't have. Rav Kook spoke so much about the non-religious and how they had piety inside them, which they didn't know about. But day in and day out, he dealt with religious Jews. Rav Uziel was dealing with very different communities. He was dealing with communities of many people who weren't Shomer Shabbos, and he had a very different conception. And when it came to women, Rav Uziel could not understand Rav Kook's position. Rav Kook sided with the extreme Haredim in this very matter. It came to the fore when the British, they had elections for the Vahd HaLumi, right after they took over, and all the great rabbis, the Ashkenazic rabbis came out against voting, so that women could not vote. I don't know if, all I can say is we know that Rav Kook is a mekil, lenient on certain Eretz Yisrael things, but in general he's a great machmir. I have Chagai Ben Artzi's master's dissertation, in which he does argue about more extremism. I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know if he became more extreme as time went on. I find it hard to believe if you read the placards, because he didn't write a tshuva about this, but he wrote he wrote letters. If you read the way he describes the role of a woman, this is not a de Haredi type of stuff. He puts it into beautiful descriptions of the role of the woman, and that her role is at home. The Haredi in their placards were that this is a breakdown in tznius, etc. Rav Kook explains the position of the woman and how a woman is beautiful, and that her role needs to be kept. So I don't know if this is one of those examples. As to the larger question, whether in general he became more extreme, I don't know. What I can tell you is that certainly there's a disconnect between his private writing and his public writing, and that applies no matter when, what era. We don't have all of his later writings. So his earlier writings, as seen in the Shmona Kibbutzim, he is saying things that he wouldn't be saying publicly. But I don't know in terms of psak. But what does Rav Uziel say? Rav Uziel says, first of all, how is it different than women going to a supermarket? The Haredim said that you're going to have women online, and they're going to be men will be there, and it's going to create sneeze problems. Rav Uziel said, what nonsense is this? Women go to the supermarket. From Rav Kook's standpoint, a woman, it's better if she'd stay home and the man would go to the supermarket. I mean, if you'd probably ask Rav Kook, I mean, or very limited, go out. It's very, very much a believer in the woman should be at home in charge of the house. But we all know, obviously, women went to the supermarkets, they did these sorts of things. So Rav Uziel said, how is this different? And what about the other argument, the argument of Shalom Bayis, the argument that you can't have two opinions in one house, that's not the Jewish way. And the apologist even argued that women made important decisions at the home, the men made important decisions outside the home. What did Rav Uziel say? He said, are we supposed to say that women don't have brains? That women can't have opinions about who their leaders are? Rav Uziel says it's actually immoral and unjust to say that women have no rights to determine who their authorities will be. No rights to determine who's going to represent them. It's amazing that a person writing, you know, when the suffragettes had just gotten going, you know, this is the 1920s, and they had just gotten the right to vote, and we'll talk in a minute about synagogues. My synagogue only gave women the right to vote, I don't know, 20 years ago. Rav Uziel, a Sephardic rabbi, we have this conception that the Sephardim are all backwards, and it's a very patriarchal society. Here Rav Uziel was arguing that women need to be treated with dignity, and in modern days, dignity means giving them rights to decide for themselves. And what about women getting elected, though? That was the other issue. It wasn't just women voting. Rav Uziel says, and this is in the 1920s, Rav Uziel says, what's the problem with women being an elected leader? What, women, they can only vote? They can only say who they want to lead them? They cannot be a leader themselves? And yes, there's the Rambam that everyone quoted, that there are certain positions of authority reserved for men. But Rav Uziel said, what are these positions of authority? A king. Maybe positions that are permanent. But an elected position is a position that, as it says, is elected. People can choose whatever leaders they want. There is no prohibition. If men and women, or just men, decide that they want to have a leader who is a woman, what's wrong with that? Absolutely nothing wrong with it. So Rav Uziel first shows that there's no tznius issue, that women are out there in the world, we talk to women, and then he shows that there's no halachic issues, finally concluding that there's absolutely no problem with women running for elective office. All this at the time when the leading Ashkenazic rabbis, forget women running for office, women were not even permitted in their mind to vote. The fundamental issue is one of acceptance. If the community accepts them, then fine. And this is all ironic, and it's been in the news recently, because there are Orthodox shuls today, many of them, including the Young Israel Charter, does not permit women presidents. I don't think it's a halachic issue, per se. I think it's a slippery slope issue. If we allow women presidents, the women will read the announcements. There are Young Israels. I was calling residents a few weeks ago at the Young Israel Syracuse. It's a very small community. There's a woman president. They told me that the Young Israel hasn't made any trouble. You know, in a small town like Syracuse, you're happy whoever wants to be president. But I asked the rabbi why he felt he had the authority to go against the Young Israel, and he said that he's the Mara Dasra. He asked Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, the RCA policy is that women can be presidents, and therefore no one, he said, at some office is going to tell him what the halacha is. But it is interesting that we do still have, and we don't have time to get into it now. I'm going to have to end now. But when we continue, and we'll get to the questions, we usually go about 10, 15 minutes. I'll talk next class. We'll begin talking what this says about women rabbis, because Rav Uziel also speaks about women rabbis, women dayanim. And from there, we'll move on to many important aspects of Uziel, primarily his view of conversion, which has received a renaissance recently with the move to the right. The extremists' conversion standards, which are being pushed to the right, we now are seeing a backlash, and with Rav Uziel, to a certain extent, they are also very extreme standards, and we'll see much more interesting and important views of Rav Uziel, which are only in recent years becoming more well-known. So let's see. We have some questions here or comments. If anyone has questions... we have no indication what Rav Uziel would say about women's prayer groups, simply because they were not an issue then. He was confronting the issues of, and he never spoke about women rabbis either. However, in his discussion about women in position of authorities, he also had to deal with the fact, are there any positions of authority that women are excluded from? And he looked at dayanim, because everyone assumes dayanim. And maybe people try to make a parallel between dayanim are leaders, therefore no leaders. You know, just like the shul president, you could say the rabbi, they're the same. And he's going to show, as I'll speak about next class, that dayanim, women can be dayanim too. There's nothing wrong with it. So that doesn't mean that if he was around today, he would support women rabbis, because this might be tied up with all sorts of political things and moving in a more conservative type of direction. But in terms of the pure halacha, before it was ever even anyone's havamina, thought to have women rabbis, we'll see that Rav Uziel is saying there's absolutely nothing wrong with having women dayanim. And obviously, not every rabbi is a dayan, but every dayan's a rabbi. So we'll see what we can at least elaborate from that. But women's prayer groups was not even an issue in those days. Or Megillah reading, or Aliyot. I do have a source, if you're interested, that none of these people know about. I spent Shabbos, I forgot to tell him, with Professor Sperber. And I'll spend the coming Shabbos also with him in Toronto. And he explained his old justification for the women's aliyot. There were, I found that in Italy, there were actually minyanim, which gave women aliyot, and but that's for another time when we do Italy. Stanley tells us that the Free State Committee for Jewish Wonder of Herzog opposed female suffrage for the future state. That's interesting. I didn't know that. I'll have to look. I have the proposed constitution here, so I'll take a look at it. I don't believe, though, that's the case, because Rav Herzog has a whole responsum talking about precisely what we can do to make it possible for women to be witnesses and for women to be members of a parliament. He has a whole argument there explaining why, just like Rav Uziel did before him, why we can have not just women but non-Jews as well. So I find it hard to believe that Rav Herzog signed on to this. But I'll look into that and get back to you. Rav Herzog did write the responsum explaining why non-Jews and women and the rest of them could be in all sorts of positions, and why they don't. These are not the authoritative positions that the Rambam refers to. Okay, any other comments or questions? We'll get to that, your question, next time about he was not a rationalist per se, and we'll end next class with something that after I show present Rav Uziel, and all the modern Orthodox world is so quick then to grab him as one of their own, you'll see something which is really amazing. He doesn't really quote Kabbalah that much, but as all Sephardic rabbis, it's important to him and it's part of his tradition, but he also knows philosophy, so it's a curious blend. At the end, he's really an ish halacha. He's not a philosopher. He's a He's an ish halacha with a universalist streak, I guess we could say. But we'll see next class in more detail how this works. Yeah, I have that series, Stanley, so I will check into that. Do you mean the series in English, or you mean the volume published by Masada Rav Kook with Chaim Herzog's introduction? Chaim Herzog published a book called Judaism, Law, and Ethics. As far as I know, he's
Masada Rav Kook. The Masada Rav Kook.
Okay, I'll look at the Masada Rav Kook, and I'll get back. I believe what I'll find there is that was one of the ideas pushed forth, but Rav Herzog writes that if the new state was going to have women's suffrage, that this is how it works. But I'll look into that to see if Rav Herzog expresses his own opinions anywhere. He does write that in one place that it would be a lot better if we kept women out of all these things, but I can't recall if he mentions voting as well. In any event, if there's nothing else... Okay, just a few words on that. He was a very brave person, a very strong person. As far as I know, he did not waver once. And I'm going to get to that next class. Rav Avadya Yosef accuses him, as we'll see next class, of giving in to the Ashkenazim, of being weak on one matter, and I think it's a misinterpretation, and it's not true. He is overshadowed, but he is a strong personality. He, in his tshuvot, he consistently writes that we cannot be pushed around by ideological arguments if they don't go with the halacha. But he was a very gentle person, and just to give you one story, every day he'd keep his office open for 2 hours so anyone could come see him. And people said to him, if you can imagine the sort of people who would come to see the chief rabbi every day, that he should have a secretary who should take appointments and keep out these schnurs and all this. And he said that the primary job of a rabbi is to be with the people, even though it took him away from his learning and other things. So he was very much a man of the people, which I dare say all our great rabbis are men of the people. This is a new thing, that to see people like the great Gedolim, that you need to make appointments, and they have what they call askanim, and they have literally people surrounding them, bodyguards, and you cannot walk in and see great figures. It used to be anyone could walk in to see Rav Kook, Rav Pesach Frank, Rav Herzog. You just knocked on the door. Today, you literally cannot do this. The Lithuanian rabbis have courts. They function like the Hasidic world. And Rav Avadya Yosef also. So Rav Uziel was from the old style. Yes, obviously there's differences in Minhagim. But when they were in the land of Israel, they turned to the idea was that when you were in the land of Israel, you for the most part adopted the Minhag of Eretz Yisrael, unless it was a very strong custom. So for example, when it came to Shabbat, the Syrian rabbis, the other rabbis, if they would turn and they would ask, you have Rav Hadaya and others, they turn to Rav Uziel. When it's about a Minhag, a specific thing, for example, women lighting the Shabbos candles before or after they make the blessing, that was always handled by the local rabbis. They never needed to turn. But on the important halachic questions, the Rishon LeZion stood above them. It's only with Rav Avadya Yosef, if you recall the earlier classes, who ruled that in the land of Israel, all communal minhagim must be pushed aside and everyone must accept the land of Israel minhag. Syrian rabbis pretty much had nothing to do with Moroccan rabbis, Egyptian rabbis had nothing to do with them, but when they come to the land of Israel, they're all together, and even in Chutz Aretz, if you look in Rav Uziel's Tshuvot, he's responding to questions from Morocco, from Tetuan, from Algeria, from all over. Everyone's turning to him, because when there was a dispute and they needed a final decision, they would turn to Rav Uziel. No, I mean, lifestyle. He lived, rabbis were never lived rich. He lived better than most people, and the Sephardim were very poor. He received a salary. We're not dealing with, it's not one of these people where they say Torah Ugedula B'makom Echad. He wasn't a wealthy person. He was, supported by the community. And, they've never been, rich. They've never even been on the richer side. I'm sorry for the beginning when we lost some things. By next week, I'll get to this question in a minute. By next week, everything should be running. We'll start 9 o'clock. We have a big crowd, and I look forward again. I'm very excited. Mayor Uziel, wrote a biography of him. I believe that's the grandson who wrote it. He couldn't have known him that well. Ruzziel died in 1953. I don't know how old Mayor Ruzziel is. And we hear that the video is much better with all the cameras off. I do like to see people. I can assure you that Torah in Motion, which pays a lot of money, and we thank the donors for making this available, they pay a lot of money so that we can have the amount of people we signed up for, and that's 50. And the fact that they did not come through this time, you can be sure we're going to, and we'll make sure next week, if there's a problem, we'll have to go down without the cameras. If he's in his 60s, well, then you do the math. He couldn't have known him that well. You know, that doesn't mean that he doesn't hear from other members of his family. Okay, well, if that's it then, thank you very much. God willing, we'll pick up next Monday night again, 9 o'clock. If anyone has questions or they need clarifications, again, you can always email me. Thank you very much, and I appreciate all the new people we have. And if you want to get a sense of what we've been doing, please download some of the earlier classes, especially last semesters. Goodbye, everyone, and Beit Shemesh. Congratulations for being up so early there. Good night.